New Orleans is awash in beads, all in the hands of some mighty happy people celebrating their big Super Bowl win in a city that has lost so very much since Hurricane Katrina. The New Orleans Saints Victory Parade today is a celebration like no other, with players and coaches rolling through town atop a caravan of Mardi Gras floats. The Saints have lifted the spirits of just about everyone in New Orleans, even those who weren't really football fans before the season. And that includes Sharon White. Now, many of you will remember Sharon from our conversations over the past 5 years. We met her at a Red Cross shelter in Baton Rouge just after Hurricane Katrina, and we followed her as she's rebuilt her home and her life in New Orleans East. We decided to check back in to find out what the Super Bowl win meant to her. And Sharon, are you there?
Yes.
And
yes,
you're mighty hoarse. Did you yell so loud that you lost your voice?
I've been howling and we just had so much fun. I went out after the game. I went to Bourbon Street, and it was beautiful. It was just one love. Everybody was just hugging and kissing and high-fiving.
Where did you watch the Super Bowl?
I watched it at home. I watched it on my TV, but I couldn't stay home. I just needed to be in that madness, and that's not me. I haven't been to Bourbon Street in years. I kept saying, please don't let a member of my church see me out here. But it was beautiful.
It's hard to understand if you don't live in New Orleans or have a deep connection to the city. But for people who have lived through so much in that city, what did that Super Bowl win mean?
I can't explain it. You know, you just got to know the story to feel it all. And just once they won, it's like if the Saints could do it, we sure could do it. I actually went out because at that moment, it wasn't about rebuilding. There's a lot of people probably was out there that's not even home, that's still rebuilding, that's still getting sheetrocked onto their homes. But at that moment on Bourbon Street, we forgot about all that. We were out there celebrating us. It was the game, yeah, the guys, yeah. But you know what? It was this New Orleans. I let it go. I was boo-hooing for the Saints that were here, like myself, and the Saints that didn't make it back. My dad died a little before Katrina, but as you know, my mom never got back to New Orleans. So that Saint, I was cheering for her. And I know there were so many other people, the mamas and the daddies and the aunts and daughters and everybody that didn't make it back to New Orleans. It was... That was for them too, you know. And I never put my dad picture in a frame until Super Bowl night. I bought him a Saints jersey that he would never wear. And I took a picture with him because he wouldn't wear it. And I put that picture in a frame Sunday night. And I said, Daddy, they did it, man. They did it.
You know, to listen to you talk about your father, it calls to mind something I read in the Times-Picayune. One of the columnists, Mark Lorando, in his column made an observation. He said that almost everybody in New Orleans will tell you that they want the Saints to win this game for somebody else, somebody to whom a Super Bowl berth would mean so much. That's exactly what you're talking about.
Right. I mean, he didn't live to see it. I mean, he loved the Saints. My dad, he would watch those games, and they were so sorry. But like I said, that win surpassed everything. And we were the underdogs. They didn't talk about us very much. It was like, yeah, they mentioned the Katrina thing and the pity party. But you know what? It wasn't about the pity party. It was those boys persevered. They played that game. Yes, it got a little scary first quarter because, I mean, I was hollering and screaming. But you know what? They came back strong, and they finished that thing, and they did it upright.
Sharon, it is always good to talk to you. It is especially nice to be able to talk to you about such a happy event.
Thank you again, Michelle. I don't want to go on. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
That's New Orleans resident Sharon White.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Blau.
And I'm Michelle Norris. The video game business is built on sequels and franchises. Grand Theft Auto 4, Rock Band 2, and endless iterations of Super Mario Brothers and Madden Football. Today, gamers can fire up their PlayStations and Xboxes with a franchise that is 700 years old. NPR's Laura Seidel reports on the video game Dante's Inferno.
First, the Cliff's Notes. The Inferno is a 14th century Italian poem by Dante Alighieri. In it, Dante imagines himself taking a journey through the depths of hell.
He's fundamentally mapped hell with this poem.
Jonathan Knight of Electronic Arts is the executive producer of the video game.
He's created a visual topography, and there's a tremendous amount of structure and geography and weather and monsters.
The poem lays out 9 circles of hell. Each circle has souls guilty of a particular sin, lust, gluttony, greed, and so forth. The punishments are symbolic of the sins. Gluttons must lie in slush because of the garbage they made of their lives on earth. Dante is guided through hell by the Roman poet Virgil. By the end of the poem, Dante has a deeper understanding of the Christian idea of sin. But to turn this poem into a video game, producer Knight says his main character had to be more active.
Our reimagined version of Dante is a warrior, he's a fallen crusader, and he's fighting his way through hell.
And doing it for love.
Beatrice!
I have to go within my love. I gave my word.
In the game, Dante goes to hell to free his great love, Beatrice. Along the way, he kicks butt, killing suffering souls. This is a far cry from the poem, which is filled with philosophical discussions and monologues about life and death. A few Dante scholars have bristled at the liberties the game takes with the Inferno, but a lot of Dante scholars don't play games. Jonathan Combs Schilling does. He's a 6-year graduate student at UC Berkeley who spends hours hunched over Dante texts, mulling over its intricate meanings. When he relaxes, he enjoys killing monsters, playing his favorite game, God of War. Finally, a game that gives him monsters and Dante.
I mean, he's a poet, and that is his... I'm actually going to find it hard to talk about the cultural worth of Dante while killing these heretics. So, but I will happily get back to that.
Combs Schilling loves certain scenes, like when Dante crosses the river Styx into Hades on the back of the ferryman Charon.
There are a couple moments where the landscape is close to being similar enough to something along the lines of how I had imagined Dante's description, that it's a little bit exhilarating.
"Abandon all hope, ye who enter here," is among the most famous lines of the poem and among the few that actually make it into the game. Combs Schilling says a lot gets lost when you're going from epic poem to video game.
In a certain way, we're not even talking about Dante's Inferno. It's a kind of a mashup of certain aspects of it.
It's part of a long tradition, Combs Schilling points out. Dante's classic poem inspired great works such as the illustrations of Gustave Doré and Franz Liszt's symphony. Combs Schilling thinks making a video game of the poem is like composing music inspired by it.
Because fundamentally it's not a narrative in the way that a movie or a text, a work of literature is.
Combs Schilling does have some reservations about the message of the game. Dante justifies a lot of killing to save Beatrice and to eventually redeem himself.
The way the game is structured, you feel okay doing the abhorrent things you do.
Despite the liberties taken by the game, Combs Schilling has no fear that Dante's 700-year-old poem will last and probably inspire many more interpretations. There's also a special print edition of the poem being published with pictures from the game that producers say might draw fans to the original. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. Long before we mastered the 140-character thought on Twitter, some of us mastered the personal ad, where paying by the word encourages concentrated brevity in the romantic resume.
"I scrimshawed this advert from the tusk of a walrus. Now make love to me, pathetic man, 49.
Woman, 36, would love to meet man to 40 who doesn't try to high-five her after sex. You know who you are."
Those are two brief yet potent personal ads from the London Review of Books. For 12 years now, David Rose has been in charge of those often hilarious Lonely Heart ads. He compiled a batch in his first book titled They Call Me Naughty Lola, and David Rose is back again with a second volume of personals called Sexually, I'm More of a Switzerland. The title comes from one ad included in the book, which reads in its entirety, "Sexually, I'm More of a Switzerland, female, 54.
It kind of sums it up, though, really, doesn't it? You get a real sense of that person with that ad, you know, awkward, bumbling, I'd really rather not talk about it kind of element.
And we never learn, you know, more than what. We don't learn, you know, more of a Switzerland than a Pakistan or more of a Switzerland than a Paraguay. We just don't know.
Yeah, I think it's kind of all that implied. You know, it's full of neutrality and cold mountains to surmount, I guess. You know, I don't know what she means beyond that, but, you know, God bless her for her brevity.
There are some common themes running through these ads, and we heard one of them just now, this "you know who you are" line. A lot of that.
Yeah, it was one of the things I noticed with the first book, that there's a whole class of adverts, and they use this line, this tagline, "you know who you are." So they've advertised before, or they've met these readers before, and they've had bad experiences, and they're kind of putting that out there. You should not reply. You know who you are. I love those ones. I think that they're amongst my favorites.
Man 41, not the sharpest sandwich at the picnic.
And a never-ending supply, it seems, of pathetic men who are actually very happy to write about just how pathetic they are.
I'm kind of reluctant to strictly call them pathetic. I think these people know what they're doing. You know, it's a clever way of getting the stuff out there.
They seem to delight in trumpeting their physical afflictions, a lot of them.
There's an awful lot of skin diseases mentioned, which is probably not something that you want to be attracting somebody with.
Love me, love my fungal skin complaint. Man, 37, charmless and flaky.
You think there's something particularly British about that?
The British are full of skin disease. You have no idea. It's incredible. It's all the rain. It makes people more moldy. They kind of stay out in the rain a lot, and then they live in very dark apartments, and a mold festers on the skin. It's called English pigmentation.
I have no idea.
You need to look it up. It's there somewhere, I'm sure. But yeah, they are kind of awkward and bumbling and uncomfortable in this kind of thing. And I don't think the English can do that thing that American advertisers can do. If you see ads in the New York Review of Books, for example, which is a very similar demographic to the London Review, American advertisers are very used to kind of putting out there all the very, very positive aspects. But in the UK, we can't do that. We're desperately awkward about it. We could never say, oh, you know, I've got a good degree, or I'm very attractive. They would play it in a very low-key manner, I think. And these ads just don't bother at all. They just say, yes, well, I live with my mum and I've got glaucoma.
What?
Please make love to me. And, you know, and who can resist that?
Who can? Who can? There's another theme, I think, that runs through these. And it's, you know, again, it's not in the I like fine dining and curling up by the fireside theme. It's people who say exactly what they are after.
Woman 35, happily married until husband sponsored an African village goat in her name as a birthday gift. Would love to meet man to 40 for whom the phrase "I'd really like a pair of diamond earrings" isn't meant ironically.
Well, there you go.
You really get an absolute snapshot of a person's life with those things, I think. And I think one of the best things about these ads is they present perfect little vignettes. They give you an absolute perfect picture of what's gone on at a certain moment in this person's life, the tipping point or whatever. And they present it as a lonely heart in a very, very humorous way. But nonetheless, you still get this image of a very definite moment, the peripatia in this person's life where they've said enough.
And creepy and often scary women in these ads.
Did you just look at that other advert? Don't lie, I saw you. Paranoid, jealous and often scary woman, 42. Do you want this marriage to work or not? You don't know the meaning of the word love. London, so why does your credit card receipt say Birmingham?
I can see this woman. I think I know her.
Yeah. There's people kind of reply to these adverts, and often they're surprised that they weren't meant in an ironic way.
Who do you think is the voice behind this ad? If I wear a mask, will you call me Batman? Just asking.
I don't know. I kind of hope that's some very opportunistic academic. I like the idea of a lot of these people being professors in their studies and finally, after all the years, allowed to be a little bit silly. It's nice. There's very much a Monty Python feel to some of these things, I think. That very British intellectual way of being very, very serious, and yet you look below the table and these people are wearing stockings and high heels. You know, it's great.
And you're talking about the men.
Absolutely.
Ever get tired of this? Ever bored by this?
Absolutely.
Every day.
I clasp my head in my hands and I weep. And
that's the start of a personal ad right there.
Yeah, honestly, I've mutated into all of these people. You know, I've taken on their pain and their sorrow and the crazy conversation. And sometimes I just kind of wake up and, you know, I wonder where it all went wrong. I had so many ambitions as a young man.
And here you are.
Now I'm jaded and broken and old. Exactly like my advertisers.
You know, I hear the personal ad. You're writing it right now. You know, I wrote this ad while clasping my head in my hands, weeping. I'm jaded, broken, and old.
Yeah, please hold me.
Pathetic man.
Yeah.
David Rose is the weeping, jaded editor of the personal ads for the London Review of Books, compiled in the new book, Sexually, I'm More of a Switzerland. David Rose, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The shift in focus from healthcare to job creation is little comfort to the many Americans who have jobs but no health insurance. As part of our series, Are You Covered?, NPR's Debbie Elliott checks back in with a New Orleans contractor who wants insurance, but insurers don't want him.
Winter, what there is of it in New Orleans, is the slow season for Fernando Ariola's construction firm. So late last year, he took care of a nagging medical problem.
I had a minor surgery. You know, it wasn't anything big, just had a growth remove. So I went to Guatemala, and it cost me a grand total of $80, including the doctor visit. I was able to save some money. I couldn't even pay for the doctor visit over here.
Ariola is a naturalized citizen who has called New Orleans home for 40 years. But his regular doctor these days is in his native Guatemala. So when he goes to visit family, he gets care and stocks up on his blood pressure medicine. The 58-year-old self-employed businessman gave up his health coverage after Hurricane Katrina to save money when times were tough. When he tried to reinstate the policy, he was denied. Ariola had hoped Congress would allow people like him to pay for early Medicare coverage.
See, I'm willing to pay for what I'm getting. You know, that's not the point. It's just that I cannot even get it.
He's frustrated that politicians can't seem to agree on a fix.
It's a mess. It is a mess. I don't know that they can do anything.
For his part, Ariola has been trying to do something locally for people like him by serving on the board of directors of a fledgling health clinic for uninsured workers. At the First Grace United Methodist Church in the Mid-City neighborhood, a construction crew is transforming Sunday school classrooms into exam rooms. It's the new home of the New Orleans Faith Health Alliance. The full clinic won't be ready until late spring, so for now, a small windowless choir room serves as a makeshift exam room.
144 over 86.
Nurse practitioner Gwen George is with a new patient.
That's a little bit high, but mm-hmm. It's not real high.
Elevated?
Right. Have you ever had any blood pressure problems?
I was diagnosed elevated, yeah.
With high blood pressure? How long ago?
Pre-Katrina.
Okay, about 5 years then.
Yeah.
Okay.
Her patient is Lee Hardy, a morning show producer for a local AM radio station. Hardy had hoped Congress would create a public health plan.
People think that it's for other people out there that don't want to work and people who are just lazy bums and so on and so forth. But that is not the case. I mean, I stand before you as living proof that that's not the case. I mean, I work hard.
How long have you been without health insurance?
Well, let's see. Katrina came in 2005 and the job that I did have health insurance with was gone. So You can mark it right back to August 29th, 2005.
And it's been that long since he's seen a doctor, even though his previous job was as a marketing director for a home health care agency. Nurse Gwen George says Hardy is typical of the patients she sees at this clinic. Most have chronic health problems like high blood pressure or diabetes and have gone for years without care. Katrina devastated the city's healthcare system, including Charity Hospital. Even today, she says, there are few treatment options.
Unless they go to the university, which is going to be free care, but it's hours and hours to wait. And when you have a job, you really can't wait 10, 12 hours to be seen because you'll no longer have your job.
Since November, the New Orleans Faith Health Alliance has been seeing patients 3 half-days a week, addressing a mere fraction of the need in this city where so many people work in industries that don't offer health coverage, like construction and hospitality. Clinic Director Luann Francis says there are about 80,000 uninsured workers in the New Orleans metro area.
We are specifically focused on serving these people because we think these people are the ones that are falling through the cracks and who go, you know, for a long period of time without seeing a provider.
But it's not a free ride. Patients must join or become members by paying a fee based on their income and pay for each visit.
Thank you all.
Thank you, baby. Okay. See you later.
Bye-bye.
Lee Hardy emerges from the exam room after an hour-long consultation.
This place is a blessing, and I'm going to recommend it to a lot of people, and I certainly do know a lot of folks who would probably qualify for the services, because a lot of people that I know are employed and not insured. And that's the reality of the New Orleans that we live in.
The clinic has signed up 15 members so far, and the newest is contractor Fernando Areola, who says the clinic will help him with routine matters like his blood pressure. But he's still concerned about major medical issues. His plan for now?
Pray that nothing happens.
At least not until he's 65 and qualifies for Medicare. Debbie Elliott, NPR News, New Orleans.
Are You Covered is about the healthcare experience of ordinary Americans. It's produced in collaboration with Kaiser Health News, a nonprofit news service.
With nearly 15 million people out of work last month, according to the latest government unemployment report, that's a lot of people competing for a limited number of jobs. Some are turning to a new generation of job search websites that claim to play matchmaker. And as NPR's Tamara Keith found, it may not be love at first sight.
Maiklin Bauman has been actively job hunting for about a year. And in that time, she's applied for a lot of jobs.
Oh, I would say at least 100 jobs here and there for my experience and then below my experience too, just trying to find something. It's a tough market.
And applying for all those jobs has been a bit like throwing resumes into a black hole with very few nibbles or even automated responses. She'd like to find a marketing job at a medical devices company near her home in Orange County, California. That's what Bauman was doing before she took off a couple of years to raise her kids. But now her husband is out of work, too, and the job search is getting urgent. Every day, she visits 4 or 5 job sites like Monster.com and CareerBuilder.
It's pretty much the same. You see the same jobs posted everywhere.
Along with a few legit prospects, Bauman says these sites are full of offers for degrees from mail-order universities and sales opportunities with Avon.
You start getting exhausted just filtering through the junk.
For the last month or so, her daily job search has included a visit to one of the newer job matching sites. It's called JobFox.
I like this site a lot. I think it's really clean, which is a positive.
Though she says she'd like it even more if it led to a job or even an interview. The founder of JobFox is Rob McGovern.
We're kind of like eHarmony, but for jobs.
McGovern started CareerBuilder back in the 90s. He says job search algorithms have come a long way since then.
You know, when the first search engines came along, you had to be a search expert. You had to do this thing called Boolean search to put search terms in and really ferret out the data. And then along came Google and said, no, we're going to build a smarter search engine. Well, the same thing's happening in jobs.
rather than just posting a resume, JobFox users fill out detailed profiles that get very specific about their skills and hopes for a new position. Then McGovern says candidates are matched up with job postings that are just right.
When you look at 10 jobs on our surface, we want you to say, wow, all 10 of those, I'd be good for that. And we want the employer that sees you to say, this person's really qualified, as opposed to the, oh, here's yet another resume I didn't want.
Mark Chabatari has applied for about 20 tech industry positions through JobFox, but so far those leads haven't resulted in any job interviews.
Is it that much better or differentiated than what Monster and some of the other sites are doing? It is different. When someone has said, hey, I saw your credentials on JobFox, let's talk, then you'll have a convinced winner.
There are a handful of sites out there now that promise more targeted job searching, with names like Indeed, The Ladders, and Quiet Agent. Monster is getting in on the matchmaking, too, with a new power search that's still in beta mode. But they all face one big obstacle, the job market itself. Tamara Keith, NPR News, Washington.
Now to Haiti. The Roman Catholic Church in Haiti is among the many institutions devastated by last month's earthquake. The cathedral in Port-au-Prince was destroyed, and Archbishop Joseph Serge Miot was killed. So were dozens of priests, nuns, and seminarians. A majority of Haitians are Roman Catholics, and the church had a widespread social service network throughout the country. We're joined now on the phone by Bishop Thomas Wensky of the Archdiocese of Orlando. Also with us is Father Andrew Small, who works for the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, and he is the director of the Conference Subcommittee on the Church in Latin America, and both men are involved in helping to rebuild the church in Haiti and minister to the people there. I thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Good to be here, Michelle.
Good to be here, too. I'm happy to join you.
Bishop, this must be very difficult for you. You have a long association with Haiti, the Haitian community in Miami. As I understand it, you attended the ordination of Archbishop Miot many years ago. And just, do you mind if I ask you, first of all, my condolences, but may I ask on a personal level how are you experiencing this tragedy?
Well, it did touch home because not only was the Archbishop a friend, but I lost other friends in the earthquake. This Friday, which will be a month since the earthquake took place, I'll be celebrating Mass in Creole with the Haitian community of Orlando here, sort of as a way to help them gain some closure. We'll pray for their relatives and friends that died in the earthquake.
How do you understand this religiously?
Well, again, we trust in God's providence, and also we also understand that we ask for answers, but not all the answers will be given on this side of heaven. Hmm. So we know that God can bring good out of evil. And I think one witness to that is the fact there has been so much outpouring of solidarity from all the world reaching out to the Haitians in this moment. So that is a sign of good coming out of the evil of this tragedy.
Father Small, I understand that one of the first, if not the first, contributions made by the Catholic Church in America to the Church of Haiti was to send equipment to rebuild a Catholic radio station in Port-au-Prince. Tell me about that.
Sure. We've had a long sort of relationship with this entire network throughout all the dioceses in Haiti. And our office is well known in places where literacy is not very high or people don't have the wonderful access to telecommunications and up-to-date ticker feeds, etc. The radio does serve an incredible purpose of connecting people. So this center, this Radio Soleil, and the Tele Soleil as well, was destroyed. Some of the technicians and the priest director was injured, actually pulled out of the rubble. And the antenna up on the hill wasn't damaged, so they needed some equipment, basic console, some computer equipment to record and send the stuff out. So we've been sort of hustling to get that in through the Dominican Republic so that people are connected again. I mean, when you don't have your house anymore, or you're in a tent village or something like that, transistor radios and the ability to hear a familiar voice is so very important to keep people connected. So we've been trying to make that happen.
I understand that they're actually broadcasting from a van. Is that right?
That's right. That's the latest report that I have. I was down there shortly after the quake, but haven't been back. And some of that is to do with still the nervousness around aftershocks and some of the trembling that goes on. And, you know, there are some buildings standing, but they feel a little bit more comfortable transmitting from a van. To the extent that they can, I think we just need to get some more solid equipment. And then eventually we'll look at how we get them a radio station back again, you know, just like NPR.
Yes, sir. Bishop, do you have any sense of the extent of loss of the church infrastructure in Haiti? Do you have any sense of how many churches, how many people?
The total is still coming in, but two dioceses were affected in a major way. The Archdiocese of Port-au-Prince, which was the largest diocese in Haiti, but also the city and the Diocese of Jacmel. So both of these dioceses lost cathedrals, they lost churches, they lost schools, they lost dispensaries, clinics. So the devastation has been almost total in many areas. Two other dioceses abutting that area, Lakai, and also the new diocese of Miragoan had also suffered some damages. But what is also happening right now is that literally thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people have left Port-au-Prince and have gone back to provincial cities and rural areas where they have some roots. And so I was in communication by email with a pastor, a parish priest in Mont Saint-Nicolas, which is about the farthest west that you can get from Port-au-Prince. It's the closest point to Cuba in the Windward Passage, and he was telling me by email how his little town has grown in population tremendously, and of course that has placed strains on the resources of these towns to feed the new population coming in, and also to provide schooling, etc. So we don't know whether that displacement of people is going to be permanent or whether they'll start drifting back to Port-au-Prince, but it does present a real challenge because now the logistics is not only about getting aid to Port-au-Prince and feeding people that are homeless in Port-au-Prince, but also to embrace the entire country.
And Bishop, we've seen many images of people praying outside of the churches, outside of just wherever they can. That has to be very inspiring on one level. On the other, it is a visible reminder of just how much need there is. And many people here are wondering what it is that they can do or should do. And I think that they're probably wondering, what is the greater need? On the one hand, people have a need to, those who believe, have a need to gather to worship. On the other hand, the church was involved in just caring for people's daily needs, you know, food, education, medicine, and so forth. How would you recommend that people direct their efforts at this point?
Well, I think, we have to look at the recovery of Haiti is going to take a very long time. And so it's not going to be accomplished by a gift, even a generous gift for this month or even next month. Some of the immediate needs are being addressed now, the medical needs of so many people. But even with those that have been injured in the earthquake, they're going to have long-range needs. There are literally hundreds of children and adults that have lost limbs, and they're going to have to be rehabilitated and also trained for some type of gainful living after in the months and years to come. Mm-hmm. But the church has been a part of the Haitian life, and it reaches everywhere in Haitian society. There's the joke about a minister of public works that was in a rural area of Haiti, and his truck got stuck in the mud, and he started cursing, saying, "What's wrong with these people in this village? Don't they have any parish priest here?" because the understanding would be that it would be the priest, the church, that would be making sure that the road was passable and that there was drinking water, and cooperatives for the farmers to get their crops to market. So the church has to rebuild its places of worship, to be sure, but it also has to rebuild its broader infrastructure of clinics, of schools, of the radio, and other ways that it continues to help the
sure.
people of Haiti.
Father Small, final word from you. Can you think of a comparable disaster that you've addressed in the region?
I really can't. We've repeatedly helped in various ways after these types of disasters. A different hue to a type of disaster like this was the hurricanes that hit the island of Cuba. And given the difficulty that at times the church has in maintaining its property, and it's certainly not allowed to build new property, there was a new set of challenges there so that people can't sort of rebuild their chapels, which are really the places, some of the few places that they can convene. So that had its own sense of urgency. But the massive scale of this, the other maybe one piece is the tremendous love that Haiti and the Haitian people find within just regular church-going folks in the United States. Massive amount of twinning going on, not only in the Catholic Church, Methodists, Episcopalians, Baptists. And I think those human bonds are ultimately what will last when maybe this goes from the headlines,
okay.
what have you.
Thank you, Father. We appreciate it. That was Father Andrew Small of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. Also with us, Bishop Thomas Wensky of Orlando. Gentlemen, we thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you as well. Thank you.
Bye-bye.